That is music, believe it or not, written by Scott Joplin from his opera Tremonisha, which was written in 1910 and then forgotten until it was rediscovered in 1972 and had a bang-up run on Broadway and has since become a staple repertoire piece. You know Scott Joplin for his piano rags. That's his opera Tremonisha. I am not Ann Fisher. I am Christopher Purdy. Ann Fisher is off today, and we are going to spend the hour talking about arias in Ebony, music by African-American composers as being performed this weekend by Opera Project Columbus. And I have with me none other than the artistic director of Opera Project Columbus, a dear friend, a professional soprano, wife, mother, and woman of who never stops, and she's here today, Dionne Bennett. Welcome, Dionne Bennett.
Thank you, Christopher. Thank you.
Before we, let's do a little business, nuts and bolts.
Yes.
Friday the 28th at 7:30 at First Unitarian Church in Clintonville.
Yes.
Opera Project Columbus presents arias in Ebony. And then Sunday, March 2nd at 3 at Faith Ministries Church in Columbus.
Yes.
And if you want to know the program, listen to the show because we're going to tell you all about it.
Absolutely.
We just heard that cut from Tremonisha, and we know that that piece was, that's a full grand opera, and it was lost for many years. So my first question is, in describing the program, where do you find the music, and why is this music all needing to be rediscovered? Where did it go?
The music, you know, I'm not even sure where it went. I know that probably larger opera companies, they point towards the big European grand opera. But this music, I was introduced to it just recently in California. At Irvine, California, there was a conference called the Art Song African Art Song Alliance, African American Art Song Alliance, and they focused on art song. However, they did a segment that was on opera, and I was asked to do a piece that had never been done, had not been done for 70 years by H. Lawrence Freeman. And
did you know who he was?
I had no clue as to who he was. And on top of that, the score that I received was gray. It was a copy, and it was totally gray. You could barely see the notes. It was all handwritten, and I was to somehow
figure it out.
And so what I had to do is I had to find the archives. I first went to Columbia University in Chicago, and then from there, they sent me to Columbia University in New York, and I found a wonderful librarian there, Jennifer Lee, and she helped me, and they had the archives. She had to contact the family to see if we had permission to do it, and then she sent me the microfiche. It's never been published. It was, like I said, it was handwritten, and even those pages were still dark.
Now, you said this is music by Freeman, assuming that he's passed away many years ago.
Yes.
You were asked to do this. Who asked you, and how did they know about Freeman?
Daryl Taylor, who is the founder of the African American Art Song Alliance. He is also a professor at Irvine University in California. He has been a trailblazer as far as African-American music. So he's done CDs of Leslie Adams, another African-American composer who's actually living. He's done a lot of things with that. And so he had talked to another gentleman, a musicologist named Bruce Falk. Bruce Falk had done his dissertation, I believe, on H. Lawrence Freeman.
So it's literally 5 or 6 degrees of separation.
Absolutely.
And it just takes the time to run through the chain there. You know, when we think of opera composers, if anybody out there thinks of them at all, I do, you do, but stay tuned because we're thinking of dead white guys.
Absolutely.
Who usually don't speak English.
Absolutely.
We're speaking of men, white men, and generally European men.
Absolutely.
All right? So how did you come up with the idea of a whole evening of music by African-American composers that the general public, they've heard of Mozart, they've probably heard of Puccini, but how did you come up with this idea?
Well, when I saw this body of music of art song, and then I saw this body of music of opera, it was just one recital, and they did like 5 different pieces of 5 different composers that day. I was one. I had done the opera, and actually the opera is called Voodoo. And the piece that I did was called Hail Subjects of the Mighty Voodoo Queen.
That works.
Once I saw this, I started kind of looking and kind of researching. Well, there were a lot of composers at this, also at this alliance. There was Marvin Curtis, there was Anthony Davis, there was Richard Thompson. There were a lot of composers there. Adolphus Hale Stork himself, he was there.
He's going to be part of our program later today, so stay tuned. Yes.
So when I saw this, then I actually went on the African American Art Song Alliance website or on Facebook and said, hey, you know, I'm thinking about doing this. What would you do if you were doing this program? I ended up calling a friend that I met there, Louise Toppin, who's acclaimed singer.
We have her recordings, yes. Yeah.
Acclaimed singer. She's also a wonderful research person. And she said, you know, these are people that I would look at. This is what I would look at. These are things that I've done. I've done excerpts.
When people come to your concerts this weekend, will there be any composer they've heard of? Scott Joplin,
yeah. You will hear.
Tell me about Tribonicia, his opera. Tell me a little bit about that.
Tribonicia, there's a whole background to it. So it started out with all these people on the plantation, and they were put in charge. In charge of them was a head African American, and so he was in charge of the plantation.
He's the boss. Okay.
So we go further into, and there was Ned and his wife Monisha, and they wanted to have a child, but they could not have one. And one day, they found Tribonicia under a tree.
Hence the name.
And so they found her, and this is basically the story of their life with her. And then all of a sudden, these guys came and stole her away. Now, Tribonicia, she was to be educated. That was their idea, their thought, that she was going to be educated and would be able to come back and train the other.
To teach everybody else.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
To teach everybody else. And so it's the story about her doing that.
I remember when that opera was revived. I'm old enough. I actually saw it in 1973. And it became a film, and it became a best-selling recording. But there was controversy then because the language was of the plantation.
Yes.
And some people had a problem. And I remember one of the leading singers says, and that's your problem, tough bananas. But seriously, people did have a problem. Absolutely. What's your take on that?
Well, you're going to also hear some other things during this show that is going to have that dialect as well. I don't have necessarily a take on it. I think that the way you choose to say it is fine. A lot of people do have issues with the dialect. I don't.
I suspect most people won't because if nothing else, maybe a museum quality to it. However, it is very vibrant, living music. I mean, of the pieces that I know that you're doing on your program Friday and Sunday of this weekend, and we'll talk more about the specifics in a bit. Why opera? What's the attraction to opera? A bunch of fat people screaming at each other. Who cares? Everybody's dead, and when they die, they still sing. I mean, nobody shuts up, okay? They can cut their heads off. They can be burned at the stake. They're still singing, and they're ugly. What's the deal?
Well, obviously, Opera Project is an opera company, and so that is what we specialize. That's what we specialize in, opera. And then opera is a wonderful, wonderful body of music.
It's in a foreign language. I won't understand it. It's boring.
Well, not this show.
Right.
This show would be all English, and we're going to have super titles as well because it is opera. So a lot of people's ears are not attuned to.
So lazy people are welcome. Yeah.
And both places, both venues are gorgeous, and
they have
what we need for that, the super titles as well. Yes, but this is opera, and it should be done all over.
I think it's a very strong way to express something. When you have an orchestra and you have voices, you have choruses, you have sets and costumes, it's kind of the ultimate Absolutely. Art fantasy. Yeah,
absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about Opera Project Columbus. Just let's make everybody aware there's Opera Columbus, but this is not Opera. No, no offense intended, but this is not Opera Columbus.
This is not Opera Columbus. This is Opera Project Columbus. Opera Project Columbus is in its third season, and the mission of Opera Project Columbus is to celebrate local talent, celebrate local singers, giving emerging professionals, giving them a platform from which to launch.
Young opera singers?
Young, but emerging.
There's a lot of young opera singers living in Columbus?
Well, there are a lot of opera singers in Columbus. And I think of my job as to shake trees to, like, let those opera singers come down and see who comes out. We've got kindergarten teachers, we've got bankers, we've got all kinds of people here in Columbus for whatever the reason. But they are trained. Some of them have hit the streets of New York.
They're not amateurs.
No, they are not.
I say that in the best sense because that means doing it for love. But these are people who've been paid to sing. Yeah,
yes, yeah. These are people who are emerging professionals. And some, I mean, we just had Robert Kerr. He was at the Kennedy Center Honors.
He was.
So,
yes.
You know, we...
Write that name down, by the way, Robert
absolutely,
Kerr. He's a talented guy.
Absolutely. Yeah. We have Sam Hall, who's...
When did the company begin?
The company began 3 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And we began with Suor Angelica, under the baton of Maestro Alessandro Siciliani. The artistic director then was Heather Spence, and the executive director was Julie Castro. And funny thing, they met at singing in a community chorus group, and they looked at each other and said, you know, we should start an opera company.
And they did.
And they actually did. So when Julie retired, and Heather decided to go ahead and launch her career and move to Maryland, they asked me, and they said, would you be the artistic director? And I thought, why not?
I want to make the point, though, because full disclosure, I know you and I've worked with the company.
Absolutely.
Dionne Bennett is also a wonderful singer. And I've always, I've been nagging at her for years, stop this artistic direct nonsense and be singing. But she is a wonderful singer. We are going to take a brief break and come back and talk with Bill Banfield from from Berklee College of Music, which means he and I were once neighbors. Don't go away. All Sides continues in just a moment. Highway 1 USA by William Grant Still, a magnificent composer, whatever color he was a very gifted composer. He was an African-American, I believe. He had some Ohio roots, and he wrote 9 operas, dozens of symphonies, ballets, and orchestral suites. And the reason that he is not well-known as he should be is why we're having this discussion today about African-American musicians, composers, and Opera Project Columbus's program. Ari is in Ebony this weekend. And joining us now from Boston, Bill Banfield, who literally wrote the book on African-American composers, speaking to us from, I believe, Berklee College of Music. Hello, Bill.
Hello, sir. How are you this morning?
I'm well. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. William Grant Still was a very prolific composer, and his music was performed, but certainly not enough. Can you just briefly tell us who he was and why it's important that we bring him back?
Well, William Grant Still is known to the world, and particularly among composers, as the Dean of African-American Composers. Born 1895 and began his professional life as a composer and a writer in New York at the same time as all the other great American composers were writing. And they were experimenting with the definition of what would be American forms and how those forms would be carried out either in popular music or orchestral music. So he's important for that reason, because he was there with Berez, with Gershwin, with Paul Whiteman, with all the folks that were in the top of the century, but he is this great composer. He is an orchestral symphonic composer, but who's someone who worked in the other fields of popular music as well.
I know the New York City Opera had done a couple of his operas, but a long time ago. And I want to ask both you and our guest, Dion Bennett from Opera Project Columbus, to Dion, from a performer standpoint, William Grant Still's music is...
incredible. I'm doing a piece from Costazzo, and Costazzo hasn't even been
published, or
it's not been premiered at all. And it is going. It's some gorgeous music. It's long lines, soaring lines, and sometimes it seems to me like movie music. And in some ways, it's some really really gorgeous. Gorgeous things.
Bill, did William Grant Still, was he very well, highly regarded, very well known generally in his lifetime and then sort of fell off the radar?
Well, he never fell off the radar.
Okay, good.
But to your point, to your guest, other guest's point, the reason why for that lyricism is because of the lyricism that comes from popular music and as well the symphonic music that they were all writing at the time. And to your guest's point about music, he was writing some of his music was used as you say, movie score music. So he was probably the most prolific and the most known. I mean, he was an oboe player who played in UB Blake's operas. So people at the time knew him as a symphonic player. And so he's coming at it from all of these sides. He's a player. He's a producer. He's also the musical director for Black Swan Recordings in the 1920s. They're the only all-black recording company at the time in New York. So this is a time that's pregnant with all kinds of discussions about the way in which American music goes. And you're right, William Grant Still is an incredible voice.
I'm going to ask Dion to mention another composer, and then, Bill, have you give us an idea of who that composer is. Somebody else from your program?
The other composers we're doing is H. Lawrence Freeman.
How about that, Bill? H. Lawrence Freeman.
There are a group of composers that it's wonderful that you're having a conversation. When you talk about Freeman's work, you talk about William Grant Still. We're going to be talking also about Scott Joplin and then moving along to Anthony Davis and Adolphus Hellstorm. This is a long trajectory of black composers. I heard earlier you were talking about why don't we know more? These people never fell off the bench. They are here. They have... The music is there. The history is there. I think that it's great that your guest and the Cleveland company is producing
Columbus.
This. Because Columbus, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
You know, Ohio,
that's all right.
We are very sorry.
We are writing this down, though. Columbus.
You got Columbus. Toledo,
never mind.
I'm from Detroit. Okay, so I love Ohio, but it's rich with cities. Very sorry. I have very, very dear friends.
That's okay.
In
let's get back. Opera Project Columbus. Now tell me, Bill, let's talk about this music in Columbus and worldwide.
Yes, absolutely. The other pieces that you're doing are by Scott Joplin and Adolphus Hellstorm as well, right?
Yes.
Okay. That's a fabulous thing that you're doing there in Columbus, and we're very excited about that because to your point, Christopher, have a chance to hear this music. And then, as your guest said, once they hear it, they hear how marvelous the music is. It's also American music.
Yes.
So, I mean, in the symphonic world, in the operatic world, I was watching the Met this weekend and the contemporary opera, and I thought we do German opera, we do all of these other operas, we don't do enough of our own. Why are we not doing American opera and concert works more?
Because the argument is, and I don't believe it, but the safety argument is because the public won't come to see it. That's a lazy answer, but that's the answer you get.
You know, this conversation is just supposed to be 5 minutes. And we have your guest there, and Adolphus is on his way, so I will defer and wait. But that is a long argument. You're absolutely right, but it's all silliness, because basically it is the responsibility of the institutions to program music that is accessible but is of historical and aesthetic value, so audiences and each new generation of audiences will not be burdened with that same kind of silliness, which is, we will not come to see that. That's absolutely incorrect. All of the stats and the data point to the fact that when you reach out and when you show the the accessibility of this music, but yet it is a high value music. It's high crafted. It has high value in terms of its intellectual compass. People will come out and hear it and love it. So that is untrue.
The other reason to do these operas and this music is because it's good.
Yeah,
it's good music, beautiful
Absolutely.
Music, you know, minus anything else. Last question for you, Bill Banfield. If there was one African-American composer that really nobody knows who needs to be performed, who would it be?
Now, that's a very politically difficult question.
Good, let's go.
It is a generationally difficult question. It is a personally difficult question because I am a composer. Okay, so for all those reasons, I will try to be objective and say that if you can't answer that question, what we need to be able to do is to do what your organization is there doing. So I would say, this is what I would challenge the organization to do. What we often do is we'll do William Grant Still, and what I love about it, you're doing a collection of contemporary composers, so people can see the, like you say, the breadth and the beauty, but there needs to be more. Why not take the next step and next year do an Anthony Davis opera? Or next year do a full opera?
Stick around.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do the full opera, then you've spent a year getting your audiences ready. Now then spend the time and really produce a full stage, great American, and I would say it doesn't just have to be African American. Right? At this point, we're global. I mean, I was on the Pulitzer Prize committee last year, and we gave the Pulitzer Prize to the first Chinese American composer. So now, why is that happening so late? So I think we have a great number of contemporary living African American composers and other composers of color who can stand toe to toe to anybody in the marketplace. Why don't we invest and do those operas?
What happened to X, Anthony Davis's opera? Had a huge, high-profile premiere in New York years ago. I saw it there. It was great. And I thought it would take off and go everywhere. It scared some people, which I don't think is a bad thing. But seriously, I don't. But what is the opera about Malcolm X? Where is it? Is that a political problem getting that produced?
Who are you asking?
I'm asking you.
We only have 3 minutes. Come on. Okay. So the Anthony Davis piece, Opera X, has the first political problem, which is called Malcolm X, okay? And it scares people. And here it is, a story about a young man who is this brilliant kid. And he's the smartest kid in his classes, and they said you have to do carpentry. Okay, and he has this great aria that is called the Children's Aria. It's one of the most beautiful arias I've ever heard, where he says, "Mama, help me. I was the best kid in school." He goes on and on. Anthony Davis has his singing in this. And then we get this beautiful, long, contemporary thing that goes into like a blues, jazz thing. That's another aria, but it's a kind of a Sarah Vaughan aria. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that people would come to see. So it has all of the great things in terms of a great story. It's a lot. It's melodic. It's contemporary. Why doesn't it get more performances? I don't know. But you know what? Anthony did not waste any time waiting to see. He went on and wrote 3 or 4 more.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
That's what you have to do. You have to be proactive as an artist. And if the historians, if the cultural apparatus doesn't see it, the heck with them. You got to go on and do your art.
Thank you for saying heck. I appreciate that here in live radio. Bill Banfield from Berklee College of Music, director of Africana Studies, a composer, a performer, a teacher, and a wonderful rock on tour. I do thank you for your time, Bill.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, God bless. Thank you, Byron. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. You can also send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. We are talking about music of African-American composers, and specifically opera, because Opera Project Columbus is doing a program called Arias in Ebony. It's this Friday night at the First Unitarian Church in Columbus, and Sunday at 3 p.m. at Faith Ministries Church. And my guest is Dion Bennett, and this Marita Hendayton has been waiting very patiently on hold. Hi, Marita. Hello, are you there, Marita?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Hi. My question is, like you said, I live in Dayton, Ohio, and I was just wondering, when they're doing these performances, are they only in Columbus, or do they travel to other areas of Ohio?
That's a great question. Let's talk about that and let's make them do it. Hang on a second. Go ahead.
At this point, Opera Project Columbus is based in Columbus. We have not been traveling yet, but there have been talks of taking our show on the road.
This program could travel.
This program definitely could travel. So yes, we'll take that to the board.
You know, if you're listening to this program outside of Columbus and you're interested, talk to your local arts presenters and see if they'll come on board with it. Look for me in the lobby of the university. I'll sneak you in. You don't have to be this Friday night. We are talking with Dion Bennett, Opera Project Columbus. How long has it taken you from starting to plan this program to opening night?
We actually began talks about this program last year. And it was a lot of research, you know, talking to different composers. Would you like for us to do your opera? What's your opera about? Could we take just excerpts from your opera? Is that okay? Then having to listen to each opera or listen to recordings. The problem is a lot of these operas have not been recorded.
Or published.
Or even published. So here I am. I am faced with, okay, word of mouth. Some people, I've done an aria from this opera. I've done a piece or a duet from this opera. At the African American Art Song Alliance, I also heard the Ave Maria duet from William Grant Still's Costazzo. Fell in love with it. But then some of the music that's not been recorded, and there are no YouTube videos, there are no, you know, this is before, some of this is before the 8-track, you know. And so I just had to sit down. I found scores in like different libraries. You know, we've got a group that would just research and try to grab the scores from wherever. OSU was a great source as well. And I'd have to just sit down with Ed Bach, the coach, and okay, yeah. let's go through this. Let's listen to it. Let's see what we have here.
You know, when you talk about, if you have a conversation of opera and African-Americans, the only thing people come up with is Porgy and Bess.
Yes.
Now, Porgy and Bess is, I think, a magnificent work, but it raises problems for a lot of African-American performers because you could get hired for that, but they won't hire you for anything else. You know what I mean?
However.
Okay.
However, you know, there's been a lot of controversy about that with Porgy and Bess, but you have to look at, in history, a lot of people have launched their careers.
They have indeed.
I mean, the reason that they've been on stage is because of Porgy and Bess.
Leontine Price, that was her first gig, yeah.
Yes, so we cannot forget Porgy and Bess. We do, though, need to recognize that Porgy and Bess was not written by an African-American composer. It was written by a Jewish composer, looking at the African-American experience. And so I think that it's better if that African-American composer has his own voice to talk about the African-American experience.
Well, speaking of the African-American experience, which I can't speak to with authority, obviously, but is that an important component in African-American composers and music, or is music music?
Music is music.
Okay.
You've got... Anthony Davis's piece that we're doing an excerpt from is about a doctor who is in the first stages of Alzheimer's.
What's it called?
It's called Lear on the Second Floor.
Like King Lear?
It's based on King Lear. Yeah. And Lear on the Second Floor, she's on the second floor, which is the Alzheimer's department.
Right.
So, you know, we're looking at the humanness,
right,
also of music.
Because sadly, many of us know what that's like to care for someone. Like, yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. But this whole show, it's not a slavery theme, and it's not a black theme. It just happens to be music of African-American composers.
So get over it. Music's music.
Absolutely.
Right. Say that to everybody. We have a call from Brigida from Blacklick, who I guess is a fan of Dion's. I'm not surprised.
Yay!
Hello.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Dion.
Hi, Brigida. How are you?
Go ahead.
I can't complain. Okay. Well, recently, family to a show from Columbus Opera Project, and I didn't think we would quite fit. My children are very active. But they did the show. My 5-year-old son said, I like the lady in the red dress, Mom. when I first heard Dion sing, she was the first opera singer that I heard to move me to tears in a way that I felt when I listened to gospel music. I think she's like an evangelist of opera in our community.
I agree.
But there was something about it that made me kind of irritated, because I wish I would have known about opera earlier in my life. So I feel like I've been robbed for the first part of my life. And I feel like the shows are very welcoming to everyone. So
Well, do you have
any plans to do that in the maybe the early education? How can we
get
kids?
We have been doing a lot of talks on even children's operas to actually get children into opera.
Not
just watch it, but actually involved. And so, yes, we have lots of plans.
Oh, well, AJ can be a tree.
Yes, he could.
Brigitte, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate
it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides. I am not Ann Fisher. I am with Dion Bennett, who is the artistic director of Opera Project Columbus. We're talking about their upcoming presentation, Arias in Ebony, Music of African-American Composers for the Opera. We're going to take a break now and come back shortly with Adolphus Hailstork, an actual composer. Don't go away. That's music by Adolphus Hailstork, seven songs of the Rubaiyat, music that's going to be performed this weekend by Opera Project Columbus. And we have with us Adolphus Hailstork. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today. We're talking about performances of music by African-American composers that wasn't getting the performance that it deserved, that needed. Dion Bennett is here, the artistic director of Opera Project Columbus. But let me ask you, Mr. Hailstork, who are your influences in music when you were growing up?
Oh, well, name the composers, and I loved them all. And I don't know, it's hard to say which one was a particular influence. I was just listening yesterday to the Samuel Barber First Symphony, which I think is a great piece, and it's one of those killed by modernism pieces, as far as I'm concerned. And it's just that side of the American populist side, Copland, Barber. I was always very attracted to those, much more than the if you can count to 12, you can become a composer side. So I'm conservative. Yeah.
But what did you mean when you said it was that Barber's music was killed by modernism?
Well, there's a whole school of romantic composers of that time that were just kind of obliterated and ignored. And I came across a term recently that said they were dismissively conservative. And so they didn't get much critical support and very few performances, and which I think is a shame. And so when I was coming along, it was you must count to 12 and be as modern as you can be. Nothing about you must be honest with your soul and yourself to produce the music that's really within you.
You were talking you're talking about people who wrote tunes, who actually wrote music that people could love.
Right. Killed melody, killed rhythm, killed harmony, killed tonality, all of that kind of thing was really under great attack many years ago, yeah.
Do you write music with explicitly racial themes?
Sometimes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you talk about maybe the difference in approach between those pieces and things that are not explicitly racial?
Well, let's say you were just playing a part of my seven songs of the Rubaiyat.
Yeah.
There's nothing explicitly racial in those. It's just making music, just for the fun of making music. But you could still make music for the fun of making music and integrating many of the elements that I think are foundational for African-American music, such as spirituals and the blues, jazz, soul music. Those things also have a place in, can have a place in our classical vocabulary.
Is classical music as a profession, as a life, really available to a young African-American musician? Was it in when you were very young, and is it today?
No. Well, it depends on what you're talking about. I'm a musician. It's always been
singers first,
and then instrumentalists, conductors, and composers last, I think, just about, in terms of getting attention. And when I was coming along, of course, Leontine Price was a queen of the opera world and a great achievement. And there are still opportunities for singers, especially. Instrumentalists probably have a tougher way to go. Conductors, not very visible in terms of getting on the main podiums. And, of course, composers are an afterthought.
Not to us, they're not. Dion, I have a question for you, Dion, related to that, because there are a lot of African-American men with magnificent operatic voices.
Yes,
I mean, you've heard them, I've heard them, we've all heard them. They are not having they are not having careers. They deserve to have careers. They are not having... What's up with that?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know. I can only go back to what Leontine Price said at one point. She said, you know, I would have gotten hired, but there was not anybody to kiss these big black lips of mine. I wonder if that's the case with the males as well.
They don't want them with the white soprano?
It could be. I don't, you know.
Do you think that's fair, Mr. Hoistock?
Oh, absolutely. It's what I call the woo factor.
The woo factor? I'm afraid to ask.
That's why black tenors have had a very tough way to go, because, you know, they often get the heroic roles, the romantic roles, and that's just the woo factor is not allowed. But a couple of years ago, I saw the Met HD production of Cinderella, and they had a black tenor.
They did, yeah. Lawrence Bromley, yeah.
It blew my mind. I thought that was absolutely wonderful.
Absolutely.
Now, the recent production of Cinderella isn't doing it that way, but I thought that was very, very noble of Peter Gelb. And some of the things he's doing, I'm really excited by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lawrence Bromley, and he's a very busy tenor. I think he didn't do it this time because he was booked. He's busy elsewhere. You've been writing music for a number of years. Has your music changed over the years as your life changes?
Oh, that's a big question. I would have to leave that for somebody else to decide. I've always been started with the singing line, and that has not changed. I never could get into pointillism and note counting as a means of expression. So yes and no. I've always tried to explore new things I have never tried before as a composer, but there's still some fundamental thing that's me.
And lastly, Bill Banfield, who was our guest earlier, considers you a mentor, as do I know many others. What would you say to a young person who wants to study, an African-American person specifically, who wants to study composition and is talented and wants to make a life?
Well, I would say learn your craft, really learn your craft, and also not just the old crafts, but also the new crafts that came around in the 20th century, so that you can draw from a large bag. And also my own personal thing, I generally don't try to influence my young people this way, but if I were talking to a young African-American, I'd say, remember your people and try to maybe perhaps explore the integration of African-American idioms in some of your music.
Thank you so much, Adolphus Hailstock. Denise, what is the music you're performing if it's this weekend?
We are doing, from Adolphus Hailstock, we're doing Common Ground. We're going to do a Negro love song, and we're going to do the accountability as well from your Common Ground.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, I met you at the African American Art Song Alliance, and I heard your four romantic love songs done by Roderick George, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is the most gorgeous. I sat and cried the whole time. I even have your autograph.
Well, I promise you that I'll sit and cry too this weekend when I hear this. I seriously, and we'll take videos of it and send it to you. Adolphus Hale Stork, thank you very much for your time. You appreciate it. Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye-bye.
I want to make time to have you. Oh, we do have a clip of Shout for Joy by Adolphus Hale Stork. Let's listen to that right now. You know, the root of African-American music, the spiritual, I guess you'd call that the root, comes from a time that was devastating to the African-American community, but often it's filled with joy.
Yes.
And that piece certainly was. It's in the title, but still it was joy. It was very joy, modern, major key, Jump for Joy. What is, why? How can that be?
You can look at, if you're down so far, you can only go up. Yeah. You know, after a while. And the African Americans, they had such a spirit within them that, like, propelled them forward, even in the worst of times. They always had their music with them, always. There was the rhythm, there was anything that just kind of propelled them.
And it was a truly folk music because it was not written down. It was passed down.
It was passed
down. It was sung to...
And yes. It was communal. Even for this show, we are... adding that too, we're having a community choir from different area groups, churches, First Church of God, Faith Ministries, Ohio Christian University. They're going to have a group there, and some of my students from Capital are going to be in this group. First UU Church is going to be in this group. So there are a lot of we're going to bring that communal aspect. We're also going to have dance. As well, that was also part of.
Do I have to dance?
No.
Good. Yeah, that scared you, didn't it? Yeah.
No.
I don't want to offer the phone number. We're kind of getting lost because the conversation here in the studio for us has been so good with the last 45 minutes. 292-8513. If you'd like to call in, 292-8513. Talk about music. Talk about the African American experience. Talk about maybe the barriers to the professional goals that people deserve. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. I'm Christopher Purdy here on All Sides in today for Ann Fisher. We are talking about Opera Project Columbus's upcoming program called Arias in Ebony with the artistic director and soprano Dion Bennett. The program is this Friday night at 7:30 at First Unitarian Church in Columbus. Tickets at the door, I'm assuming, but get there early.
Yes.
And Sunday afternoon, March 2nd at 3 at Faith Ministries Church in Columbus. Be there or be square. I suspect that this is going to be the musical event of the season, because you're going to hear music you've never heard before, and you are going to be filled with joy.
Yes,
which
you are.
At opera, you're not always. And no one dies.
No one dies.
No one dies. Great.
Not a soul.
That's great. Who's singing? Tell me. Who's performing?
We have, of course, Robert Kerr, Samuel Hall, tenor extraordinaire. We also have some newcomers, Franklin Brewer. He's a tenor. We have Carolyn Lee, who's been around Columbus, and she's absolutely gorgeous and absolutely a fantastic singer. We've also, I will be singing as well. Carolyn Redman will be returning. Yes, yes. And we also have a surprise. Stephen Butler, who is an Ohio native, made his living doing Porgy and Bess tours. He's been all over the world. He graduated from OSU. He's coming back, and he's going to be singing with us. So we are looking forward to an incredible time. We've got Kristen Kurevile, who just did Merry Widow with Opera Columbus.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And Coral Odom, we first heard her at Masquerade in October, But this woman, oh my goodness, she's going to be doing the Lear on the second floor. You don't want to miss her. You don't want to miss her.
When the program is finished Sunday, when you've done the last performance, again, this is something really I think could travel very, very well. What would that entail? Would you cast locally if you went to a different city, or would you bring everybody with you?
Some of the music is a bit tough. You've got the Lear on the second floor. It's got these jazz rhythms, but the piano part has nothing to do with the vocal.
And oh, so, good.
until you hear it together. No, I make sure though that I'm doing this for my audiences. So it's going to have like a catchy tune that you're going to take with you.
Feel free to move too if you're in the and seriously if you're in the audience, because I think the era of sitting with your straight back sitting there in silence and not moving in the dark is over for audiences. I think that's really on its way out.
I think you'll not have a choice. You right. will definitely want to move, especially with the dances. We're going to do the Treemonisha choruses and. And yes, you're gonna have fun. It's short. It's not a 3-hour program.
Okay, time for pizza afterwards. So
absolutely,
we are talking about Opera Project Columbus, different from Opera Columbus, and we love them both.
Yes.
We have a call from David in Albuquerque. Hello, David.
Yes, hello.
You're
Hi,
on,
David.
Hello, I just calling to wish the very best for Opera Project Columbus and their Arias of Ebony. I hope this is not the last that we will have a program of this caliber.
Well, David, thank you very much for that call and your good wishes. I suspect you're related to my guest today, but we'll leave the audience to guess that. But thank you very much for that call. I appreciate it. You'll call him later if you want
Absolutely.
Something.
Yes,
that is, great to have that call. Great to know more about Opera Project Columbus. So what's the future of your company, Opera Project Columbus?
The future of Opera Project Columbus, well, immediately, in our immediate future, is I Pagliacci.
Oh, more Rice Krispies.
Yes. And that's going to be in June on Father's Day weekend, and we are looking forward to it. That's
now, they die in that one. A couple of people die in that one, yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, you can't live forever. You know
right.
what I'm saying?
And there
you
are can't better, live. There are worse ways to go, I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that's going to bring Maestro Siciliani back to the podium.
Alessandro Siciliani was the longtime music director of the Columbus Symphony, whose pedigree is Italian opera. He grew up literally in one of the great opera houses in Italy that his father ran. If anybody can sell a theater out in this town, it's Alessandro Siciliani.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How did he get hooked up with you?
He is the friend of Dr. Benedetti. And when Julie and Heather got together and decided to start this opera company, Julie was working with his daughter, with Dr. Benedetti's daughter. She said, you know, I know the maestro. My family is very good friends with them. They all hooked up. The rest is history.
The rest is history, yeah.
The rest is history.
Bill Banfield threw out a dare. He said, do a full-length opera by an African-American composer. And I did see your eyes. I saw a little terror, but then I saw, you know, you coming very, very lively here about that. So what about that? What would that entail?
You know, I am not quite sure. We have been talking about this. One of my thoughts is I would love to do the Lear on the second floor, which is about Alzheimer's.
Well, again, people know what that is. Yeah.
Again. So we will see, though.
Okay. Stay tuned.
Absolutely.
Opera Project Columbus this Friday night at the
First
Unitarian Church in Clintonville.
Yes.
And then again, March 2nd, Sunday at 3 p.m. at Faith Ministries Church Opera in Ebony, Arias in Ebony. I thank you, Dion Bennett, very much. I'll be there. I hope everybody else turns out for this rare program and magnificent program. And I suspect we're going to be hearing a lot more of this company. Thank you, Dion Bennett.
Also, you can go to our website, operaprojectcolumbus.org, for any other questions and for tickets. And it talks about, you know, all of this.
Okay. Be there. And I think you're going to hear music that you you're glad you're hearing for the first time. And
Absolutely.
I suspect we're all going to go out humming. Thank you very much. I thank Amy Jurovich, our producer. I thank our producer, Michael DeBonis, and our assistant producer, Rachel Quimby. Thank you, Ann Fisher, for letting me on today. I appreciate that. I'm sure she will be back with you shortly. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher and Christopher Purdy. Good afternoon.